The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, The Creation.
Well, I made a bad mistake time before last. I said that, Hopper said that all religion was cosmology, all cosmology religion. Of course, he didn't say that. He said all science is cosmology. And all cosmology, of course, science, but all science is cosmology. Now, the other remark that all religion is cosmology could have been made, would be made by somebody like Santayana. And Goethe would certainly say it. Der Wissenschaft und Kunstbesitz der hat Religion. These abiden this besitz, der hat Religion. He says, who knows or who has science and art, he has religion. That's right. And if you don't have them, well, you'd better get religion, he said. But it's sufficient, you see. If you had a complete knowledge of science, then you'd have religion. And if you have no knowledge of science at all, then you'd better get religion, he said. Well, anyway, we've been speaking about Joseph Smith's restoring certain basic religious teachings which the world had lost. Notice we're not going into the scientific thing. We're just keeping it to scriptural stuff all along here, the old record. And we say the Pearl of Great Price is the best guide to such lost teachings. So far, we've talked about the literalism of it and the preexistence. And last time, we talked about cosmology. Now we come to the sorest and touchiest subject of them all. This is a blister. The subject of creation, of course. Even those at the BYU, we're divided on it right here. There are two totally different schools of creation right in our midst. And the problem is that we don't have a dichotomy here. We have a trichotomy, a tricky trichotomy. Trichotomy is a word. Dichotomy is used a good deal by philosophers. What's his name? Sterling McMurrin up at the U of U just adores the word. He works it to death. And nobody ever says trichotomy because that's what we have here. Well, see, philosophers don't believe in trichotomy. Hegelian dialectic calls for dichotomy. Everything has an opposite. Every thesis has an antithesis. They get together and form a new synthesis. But every thesis, and that's natural, there should be two. Now, why should you insert a third element? Well, you can't, really. It must come from another world. And that's why Joseph Smith spoils it with his trichotomy. We'll see here. Let's put the fancy word trichotomy. It's in the dictionary. I looked it up. Well, you know what anatomy is and what appendectomy and so forth means to cut up. And dichotomy is to cut into two pieces, cut down the center. Trichotomy is to cut into three pieces. And that's what we've got to deal with here. In the normal dichotomy of things, the Egyptians were dyadic in everything. Everything divides in two. And we do that too. We see it's good and bad. The two kingdoms and so forth and so on, they divide up. We're in between them now. We don't belong to either one. We'd have to make up our mind between them. But tertium non datur, there is no third. In the natural order of things, there isn't. It was this and the opposite had no third, but in the order of the world, but Joseph Smith brought in something else. Mormonism is a tertium. It is another world, and it just doesn't apply. Now, the classic dichotomy from the very beginning has been what? Between science and, you think science and religion is a modern issue? It isn't at all. This is ancient. It began with the school of Thales. It began, and it didn't begin then, the Miletian school. Remember, 585 BC, Thales of Miletus predicted an eclipse, and it happened and so forth. The Anaximenes and the rest of them, the school of Miletus, decided, look, the things of religion, the things of heaven, there is a God and so forth, but they're imponderable. You can't bring them into the laboratory. You can't weigh them and measure them. So for our purposes, let's just leave them out of our calculations. Since that's an unknown quantity, we can't use it. We'll just leave it out. We don't need that, and that's what they did. And before long, they decided, well, it's extra baggage. We don't need it anyway, and then it became a pernicious nuisance, and we should get rid of it. To have true science, you don't have it at all. So way back, and of course the Egyptians, the same thing. You do have this big quarrel between science and religion, as if they were different things, for that reason, see. Because religion deals with things that science can't find available. If you can't talk about it, especially if you can't measure it, you can't be sure about it, if it's subjective, keep it out of the laboratory. Well, the laboratory gives you all you have. That's all you know. So forget about the other. That's just excess baggage. And that's the course that's been taken. Well, the classic dichotomy is that then. And which gives the true explanation is the question, of course. We're speaking and always will be speaking. Now, this is the point, you see. When we say science versus religion, we are speaking as you would speak 10,000 years ago, as you would speak 3,000 years ago, as Heraclitus of Ephesus was very well aware. He kept rubbing it in here. You're speaking not of science and religion, but only of conventional contemporary science versus conventional contemporary religion. And now we can quote Karl Popper, where both are concerned. You're dealing with something that's always tentative. You do not have the final answer. The last returns aren't in. You're not going to settle it until you know a lot more than you do about both of them. And you'll never know enough as far as that goes. Since the answers are always tentative, what do you do? See, what we're speaking of, what Joseph Smith has given us, what we have in the Pearl of Great Price, is something that conventional contemporary religion doesn't have because they lost it, and conventional contemporary science doesn't have because they never found it. Well, so Joseph Smith didn't go to either of these for his instruction, and he offended both of them. His followers have always tended to take sides, though, because they're stuck with the two. Remember, Joseph says, whenever I start talking about this creation business, people fly apart like glass, he says. They can't stand the fire. They will stick to their old traditions. I can't even bring it up. They want to string me up to the nearest tree, he says, if I start talking about that, because their prejudices are so deep and so established. So And it was the same way with the scientists, as we'll see here, some interesting remarks. But today, we see they've taken side and still do. They're unable to disengage themselves from the world and its ways. We live in it and we're stuck with it until we get rid of certain things. In the same way, we've taken sides on matters of economics and politics, both being totally alien to the gospel, both extremes. So today, one feels obliged to be either a fundamentalist or a Darwinist, for example, though the gospel rejects both. The one, fundamentalism teaches, of course, following Thomas Aquinas' definition, creation is creation out of nothing, instantaneous and simultaneous. Instantaneous, as Aquinas says. In 1 second, that's all it took to create. And at that sentence, at that moment, not just part, or a beginning was created, but it was all created. Simultaneous, instantaneous, and complete, all at once. And by the other, by the Darwinist, creation by nothing. The one says creation out of nothing, the other says creation by nothing. Without plan and without direction, what created? Well, chance. Please define chance for me. Well, just what happens, that's all. You cannot, just what the way things happen to be, and there's no direction and there's no plan, so we have creation by nothing, as creation out of nothing, and we reject both of them. Pearl of Great Price is the best reply to both of them. Now, the most famous newspaper man in America, there were two of them, as you know, the most celebrated journalists, the most that had the biggest effect in the country, the greatest impact, were Horace Greeley, who was such a friend of Brigham Young's, and James Gordon Bennett, who founded the New York Herald, which for many years was the foremost newspaper in the country. And James Gordon Bennett, he was a very able man, and both of them had a lot to say about Mormonism. It's an interesting thing. And this has to do with the Pearl of Great Price. That's why it's interesting here. Excuse me again. In an editorial in the New York Herald for Sunday, you have it here, April the 3rd, 1842. Why would that be significant? Because in the middle of March, 1842, the first publication of the Pearl of Great Price. In the times and seasons for, it was meant to be the 1st of March, the 2nd of March, turned out about the 10th of March. But anyway, it was in March, middle of March, 1842, we get the first issue of the Pearl of Great Price. It included the facsimile number 1 and the explanations thereof and some chapters. Up to the 18th verse of the second chapter of the Pearl of Great Price had appeared in the times and seasons. Well, less than a month later, it's picked up by the New York papers and the Boston papers, and they're quite excited about it. It really galvanized, electrified the nation. We don't pay any attention to it today, but you'd be surprised about what an effect it had. And James Gordon Bennett, by his name here, used to hear a lot about him in my day. James Gordon Bennett, 2 Anthony T. I think it's both
Bennett family?
Yeah.
Who is the most famous influential newspaper editor of the time writes this in an editorial just April 3rd, just a couple of weeks later. Not later than that. He got hold of it pretty fast. This Joe Smith is undoubtedly, well, let's put the date on anyway, which is important. April the 3rd, 1842. Remember, this is when the first part of the Pearl of Great Price appeared in public. This is when it was first published. It had it, you see, since 1835. But this is when it was printed and got out, these first two chapters, to the middle of the second chapter. No, the 18th verse of the second chapter. So he goes, this is what Bennett says, this Joe Smith is undoubtedly one of the greatest characters of the age. He indicates as much talent, originality, and moral courage as Mahomet, Odin, or any other of the great spirits. And notice he mentioned Odin because at this time it was popular to regard Odin as the great folk hero of the North, as a real hero, a real person who lived thanks to the writings of Carlyle and his heroes, hero worship, and so forth. He makes a big thing of Odin, and so did others. Max Müller. See, Odin is the Wotan of German mythology and the Odin of the North. They thought he was a real person and a founder of civilization, and could very well have been. We won't go into that now, that's another story. You take the saga class for that. And we have some good stuff on that here. Well, but he says, as Muhammad, Odin, or any of the other great spirits that have hitherto produced revolutions of past ages. In the present, now this is the interesting thing. This is what Joseph Smith is correcting, according to Bennett. In the present infidel, irreligious, material, ideal, geological, animal magnetic age, was the time when they thought that science, a lot of it could be explained by animal magnetism, that was mesmerism and so forth. They didn't know what electricity was, Galvin, and they were just, and Volta, were just beginning to be aware of this mysterious power of electricity. Of course, today we know all about electricity. We know it runs through wires and you get a bad shock and so forth. But today we still don't know what it is. Nobody has the vaguest idea to this day. Unsatisfied electrons, I suppose, that have to be fed, but and goes along the wire. But this was the scientific world at the time that Joseph Smith, notice the religious world is up in arms against him, but look what he's doing to the rest of them here now. Geological animal magnetic age of the world. Some such singular prophet as Joe Smith is required to preserve the principle of faith and to plant some new germs of civilization that may come to maturity in 1,000 years. While modern philosophy, which believes in nothing but what you can touch, now this is 1842, we say, well, that's today. That's our scientific age today. They were just as disillusioned in those days. They didn't, and their religion was, as we've seen, their religion is abstract and immaterial. You see why they wouldn't, why the two couldn't meet? Because science would believe only in what you could touch, and religion would not believe in what you could touch. Anything tangible was not spiritual. It was irreligious, it was physical, it was corrupt, and so forth. Neoplatonism. But anyway, modern philosophy, which believes in nothing but what you can touch, is overspreading the Atlantic states. Joe Smith is creating a spiritual system, combined also with morals and industry, that may change the destiny of the race. Joe is a magnet, and then he goes on and raves for quite a while and says, Joe is a magnet in a large way, which he calls a power or spirit from heaven. In other respects, Joe is a mighty man of God, possessing large stores of human nature, great shrewdness, and as he has taken the management of the Mormon newspaper organ, the Times and Seasons, into hand, we look for many revelations and some curious ones, too, pretty soon. Darn typewriter. Incidentally, the editorial began by explaining this. He says, we give this day's paper a very curious chapter from the Book of Abraham. So what brought this on is the Book of Abraham, not the Book of Mormon, or the Doctrine and Covenants, but the Book of Abraham is what caught people's attention, because of its tangible nature and so forth. We give in this day's paper a very curious chapter from the Book of Abraham, which we find published in the last number of a weekly journal called The Times and Seasons, conducted by Joe Smith. Well, it's Joseph in this case, because he puts a period after it, J-O period, by Joseph Smith, the great Mormon prophet in the city of Nauvoo, Hancock County, Illinois. And the article concludes, we certainly want some such prophet to start up, take a big hold of the public mind, and stop the torrent of materialism that is hurrying the world into infidelity, immorality, licentiousness, and crime. 1842 he's talking, not 1986. Professor Lyell, now Lyell, remember, was the founder of modern geology at that time. In Scotchman down at the beach, he looked the deposits of the sandstone, said that this must have taken millions and millions of years, and then started things going. Richard Adams, Adams Locke, Dr. Brisbane, who became the chief, his son became the chief editor of the Hearst newspapers for years. The Arthur Brisbane was the oracle of the nation for when I was a kid. But this was not this Brisbane, not 1842. I was not a kid in 1842. It doesn't make any difference. Ed Master Emerson, notice he even spoofs Emerson here. Wasn't Emerson quite spiritual and so forth? No, the whole New England school was enlightened in this way. And the Prophet Brownson, who was really stirring up things, and Horace Greeley, there's your magnetism of life, and Horace Greeley, the rival editor. And all the materialists of the age ought to take a leaf of common sense out of Joe's book. Now, you notice in this editorial, there is not a word about the ministry. Why don't they cheer for him if he's attacking, he's not attacking anything. Remember, Joseph Smith doesn't attack. You'll notice we find nothing in the Articles of Faith, say, we denounce this, it doesn't even mention the apostasy in the Articles of Faith. It's what we do believe, not what we don't. We're not interested in other people being wrong. Joseph Smith doesn't attack anyone in the same way. He never attacked the ministry, but they certainly attacked him. And he didn't attack the scientists here, but he preached something that would take the place. Pearl of Great Price, good case of the Pearl of Great Price, filling in the gap. The religionists keep silence, and the scientists here keep silence too. And as he says, Joe Smith moves into the gap and tells them what will do some good here. But why don't the ministry cheer for him then? What do they teach that so sets them against the prophet? See, remember, they didn't like him at all, especially because he was a riot, because they rivaled each other. They didn't like each other and so forth. Yes?
Where can Bennett's editorial be found?
Oh, yes. You can find this in a book. I think I better put it on reserve. It's J. Todd. Collected a lot of stuff here. J. Todd. J. M. Todd. In a book called The Saga of the Pearl of Great Price, published by Deseret in 1969. We have several copies here. I noticed another number of copies on the shelf yesterday. I better put it on the shelf today in case somebody might want to look at it, because it has this and a lot of other relevant stuff about this, relevant and irrelevant as far as that goes. It's all about the mummies and things like that really aren't important as far as I'm concerned. We know the mummies are any man, anybody knows that, you know, so he didn't use the mummies, he used some texts and the like. That isn't the issue. But he's brought together all sorts of odds and ends in the book, which is quite a useful one. And he cites these editorials. He cites another one. At the same time, the same week, the Boston Ledger, which was the big New England paper, the intellectual paper, devoted the whole front page to the Pearl of Great Price, to the Book of Abraham, with a big picture of the facsimile number one on it. Which does the Book of Mormon, the Book of Abraham actually, most contradict, science or religion? Must we take sides? We must take sides as long as we ignore the Pearl of Great Price, but if we don't pay more attention, if we pay more attention to it, which we should begin to do, then we won't be so disturbed and torn apart by this issue. 3 days later, the Boston Daily Ledger, this is also quoted in, who has a good index in Todd's book, The Saga of the Pearl of Great Price. 3 days later, the Boston Daily Ledger devoted almost the whole front page to the Book of Abraham. The editor, William Barton, this is one of the Bartletts, the most famous intellectual family. You've heard of Bartlett's quotations and things like that. William Bartlett, a scientific writer, and another William Bartlett, who was a writer on art and so forth. Oh, they were a very eminent family. And William Bartlett, this is his editorial. We shall publish tomorrow Joe Smith's translation of the Book of Abraham, the original of which Joe says he obtained from a papyrus found in the catacombs of Egypt. Smith is decidedly the greatest original of the present day. He carries all before him when he undertakes an enterprise, knows no impediment, and never halts in his course till he has accomplished his object. And he says a lot more of that, and says he is a genius and a rare one. And all the armies of Satan, should they confront him in a solid phalanx, would be sure to meet with sore discomfiture, if not complete annihilation. I don't know how this went over with the ministry in Boston. We have so high an opinion of Joe Smith that we intend to open a correspondence with him in order to acquaint ourselves with all his secret springs of action, and thus get all the secrets of his success, public and private, worldly and ecclesiastical. The chapter from the recently rediscovered Book of Abraham and the unique cut which illustrates it, on our outside, they printed it in that issue, you see, had occasioned us some expense, but we care not for that so long as we please our patrons, which we mean to do at all hazards. So, note that it is specifically the Book of Abraham that impresses these men here. So, Our attitude, then, when we talk about the issue of the fighting between science and religion, is not a plague on both your houses. But rather we say, here comes somebody who's been there, or says he has, and produces a lot of interesting credentials. Now let's ask him, see what he says about it. And that's what we're supposed to do here. You know again. And so this semester I intend to avoid the scientific aspects of the question, which have sidetracked me again and again, calamitously, since I don't know anything about the subject. There's some very good popular works coming on, bringing us to date on science. You know, this one we mentioned before, the one by Zhukov, Gary Zhukov, the Woolly Master and so forth, which is required reading in the honors. Well, anyway, what do we find him? And so I intend to avoid the scientific aspects of the question, and they're always tentative anyway. And it's the historical literary evidence we're going to consider now, and there's an awful lot of it, and we're just going to consider it, of course, superficially. It should not be ignored, in spite of the great problems and difficulties that it too raises. And the reason I've turned to it is because it is ignored. The thesis has been this year that we find in the Pearl of Great Price the authentic teachings of the earliest records, not of what science would be if science knew all the answers, but what the earliest records actually were. The earliest records of the Jews and Christians, denounced and deleted by the doctors of the schools in late antiquity and resulting in very incomplete record, faulted, complex, misleading, and so forth. Well, the Pearl of Great Price will put us back on the track, the original. So the subject today is that touchiest of all subjects, the creation. And the council in heaven is what takes priority here. It looms magnificently. You find it everywhere, and it's one of the things that's overlooked all the time. But it is number one. It's your first consideration when you talk about the creation. Other things we may see will have to do with it. You don't want to get bogged down on creation. But in the there's something else which is on reserve, I'm sure it is. It's from a BYU, reprinted in a BYU Studies, Volume 7. It is the second faculty research lecture that was given here. They have the yearly set. It was the second that was by me, and it is on this subject, particularly subject. And I remember when Eliade read it in Chicago, he was enormously impressed and excited about it. We'll have occasion to refer to Eliade here. Yes, very soon, as a matter of fact. He is the great authority on comparative religion, you know, everybody quotes him like mad. Well, we'll get to him. But here, I'm going to quote a little from that, just to cover ground quickly, to show what the early Jews and Christians thought about this, and it played a very dominant role here. Yes, you can get it either in the bound on the shelf, or we have several bound copies of BYU Studies. It's Volume 7 of BYU Studies. You can get this. This has to do with the Council in Heaven more than anything else. Eurysthenes, and it's an early volume, Volume 7, and it was, actually that was given a long time ago, March the 17th, 1965, 20 years ago, imagine that. Oh, 1965. I don't think it was 65, it may have been 66 or something like that. The talk was in 65. The newly discovered Jewish and a Christian, we talk about the newly discovered ones, that's always our case here because they're the oldest and the best we've had. Why must they be newly discovered? Why didn't we know them all along? They hadn't been destroyed, they'd still been there. Absolutely taboo. Remember the doctors of the church, the rabbis wouldn't touch them with a 40-foot pole and condemned anyone that was guilty of them. Remember it says in the Talmud, anyone, any student who asked the question, the big questions of Clement, where we came from, where we're going, when the earth was created, what happened, was there a pre-existence, are there other worlds? Any student who asked such a question, it was better he had never been born. That's the way the doctors view it, of the Jews and the Christians too. And so it's the newly discovered ones. They've been hiding all this time. They've been out of the way. How they survive is interesting. Book of Mormon, they were buried. That's why. They're all buried. The Dead Sea Scrolls were buried deliberately to come forth at a later age, buried with great care and blocked up and sanded up and everything else. And the same thing with the Nag Hammadi library, put in jars, buried, hidden away, and to come forth. Otherwise, remember the Book of Mormon says to come forth in their purity. Whenever people handle documents, they spoil them. You cannot copy, I cannot copy, nobody can copy notes without making mistakes, then making corrections, and before you know it, you hardly recognize what started. You can start a simple English sentence, start it going around here, He copies it down, folds it over, and the next person copies down just what he wrote, not what he copied from, but he wrote, folds it over, the next person copies what she wrote, and so forth, and hands it around. Well, before it's gone through 10 people, you won't recognize that sentence. This is what happens when you copy things. You try this. It's quite an interesting experiment. Well, and so it's the newly discovered ones that have come back, and because they've been preserved in their purity, because that's the only way they can be preserved. They have much to say about the council in heaven and the plan laid down at the foundation of the world. We should be aware of it. Now, according to Ben Sirach, the wise Ben Sirach, the great assemblies of Israel were the ritual repetition, not merely of the gathering, talking about the Old Testament assemblies in Deuteronomy and Leviticus and so forth, when Israel was required to assemble once a year, and when it assembled for its great festivals and so forth. These, he said, were the ritual repetition, not merely of the gathering at the foot of Sinai when Moses brought them together to counsel them, but specifically of the great assembly that met above at the creation of the world. When God set before them, the human race to be, the covenant of the law of life, and showed them his judgment, their eyes beheld his glorious majesty, and their ears heard his voice. Now, Ben Sirach is in the Bible. It's one of the great, it's wisdom, the greatest work of Jewish, of Hebrew wisdom literature. And Ben Sirach, incidentally, that is 17, 11, and 3 in Ben Sirach. I'm going to look him up. Chapter 17, verse 11 to 13. But this is what happened. This all represents the time when God set before the human race to be a covenant, the law of life, and showed them his judgments. Their eyes beheld his glorious majesty. According to Second Baruch, who was a contemporary of Jeremiah and Lehi, in fact, he was the secretary of Jeremiah, and he and Ezra both wrote books at the same time. He was in charge of the big question that worried him was, why should Israel fall? Why would it become the captives? We were bad, yes, but we weren't nearly as bad as the people of Beta that took us captive and destroyed us. And the Lord said, that's the very point. Like the Lord says to the Nephites, the Lamanites have I cursed with a sore cursing. Nevertheless, they shall smite you to destruction. Aha. Let that be a lesson to us. Well, their voice beheld, and according to Second Baruch, the whole plan of the history of the world is set forth in detail when the Mighty One took counsel to create the world. He presented his plan to them. And you find Second Baruch, incidentally, in that big book of R.H. Charles. Remember, we said the Old and New Testament, the Old Testament Apocrypha. Should have picked that's on reserve. According to the Book of Enoch, this is a very important recent discovery. In the beginning, the head of days, with head like white wool, sat with a son of man beside him upon the throne of his glory, and the books of the living were opened before him. These books were the register of the names of those who were to live upon earth. They had a big roll call to make sure that everybody would be there for the presentation of the plan. Then the calling of the mission of the Son and the plan, both of which are kept secret until then, were revealed to the elect before they came here. As you remember, in the Book of Abraham again, too. It's not too much to say that the dominant theme of the Thanksgiving hymn, the Hodiot, the most wonderful of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a collection of hymns, Thanksgiving hymns, Hodiot means Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving hymns, that is the theme. It is the ecstatic contemplation of the wonder of man's participation in the heavenly affairs back to the beginning. Now here's hymn 6, or hymn F, from the Hodiot Scrolls. Again, this was discovered and published in the early 1950s, not till then. Thou hast caused me to mount up to an eternal height and to walk in an inconceivable exaltation. And I know that there is a hope for everyone whom thou didst form of the dust in the presence of the eternal assembly, and that the sinful spirit whom thou hast purified of great sin may be counted with the host of the saints and enter the society of the congregation of the sons of heaven. Thou didst appoint unto man an eternal share with the spirits that know, to praise thy name in joyful unison with them, and to recount thy wondrous works in the presence thereof. This is the great creation hymn it's referring to, when the sons of God shouted, the morning stars sang together. Well, the whole point of this is that man actually belongs by prior appointment to that community of the elect who share in the knowledge of the plan and who shouted for joy at the foundation of the world. The hymn preceding this, God is hailed as the Prince of the Gods and King of the Venerable Ones. And we remind ourselves, this is neither a Gnostic nor a pagan production. This was Orthodox Judaism back in those early days. And then we go into the baffling 10th and 11th. Back to Clementine recognitions. At the beginning of the Clementine Recognitions, we didn't get that far, but it's in the 24th, right in the first chapter there, in the 24th verse, when he meets Peter, Peter tells him this. Peter tells him of the plan of God which he announced as his own will and desire in the presence of the first angels, and which he established as an eternal law for all. He gave it to them as the law in the beginning. And the Gnostics give it a characteristic in one of the Nag Hammadi, one of the Coptic texts, they give it a characteristic Gnostic twist. My Father, the joyful, glorious light, says the Psalm of Thomas, summoned all the eons of peace. The first angels have now become mere abstractions. They're simply the eons of peace. All his sons and all his angels, and established them that they might rejoice in his greatness and share it. All bowed the knee before him and sang his praises together, hailing him as the illuminator of worlds. It's the same picture, see, but now this is a very early group in Egypt. Were they interpreting this mystically, or whatever it was, they knew about the council. This is the very same picture we get from the Clementine, see, where he says he summoned all the angels of peace, all his sons and all the angels, and established them that they might rejoice in his greatness. Remember, 38, the first chapter of Moses. This is my work and my glory, remember, to share it with man, to bring about the eternal life and immortality of man. All bowed the knee before him and sang his praises together, hailing him as the illuminator of the world. Oh, darn, hay fever at all seasons. The newly discovered creation apocrypha. Now that will deal with the creation, all right. The creation apocrypha, that's the name it goes by. And incidentally, we have all these texts here. They're the Coptic texts. We have them all over in the... And Coptic is, fortunately, not the most difficult language in the world. It was never required of ministers until 1950, at least. It was Greek. They had a bad enough time with that. But I recommend Coptic because it's fun. It hangs together beautifully, and it's not hard. It's not like some other thing. But anyway, the Coptic text tells us, on that day began the discussion in which God's angels and men participated, the day when they were to discuss the creation. And the decisions of the discussion were then carried out by God's angels and men. We will go down. And they saw that their plan was being followed. This is all told us in the book of Abraham, as you know, third or fourth chapters. But the prince Jaldabaoth did not understand the power of faith. Again, what do we read in the book of Moses there? Where it said, Satan sought to destroy the plan, the world, for he understood not the mind of God. For he knew not the mind of God. That's the most encouraging word in all the scriptures, as far as I think of. Satan has a terrific game going, and he wins hands down all the time, but he knows not the mind of God. He's not going to win. But Prince Jalbo did not understand the power of faith, and so was denied authority over matter. Very interesting quotation. He didn't have authority over matter, which the others shared. The power of faith, it will be recalled, was the power, we were told, by which the worlds were created. So here we get the same picture, both from the Coptic source and from the Dead Sea Scroll source, written about the same time. And we get then the earliest writings after the New Testament were the seven apostolic fathers. The last of them to be discovered was the Pastor of Hermas. Again. And the unimpeachable Pastor of Hermas is quite as specific. It tells us, this was written about 120. Hermas was the brother of the Bishop of Rome, supposedly, and this is a lamentation on the speed with which the apostasy has overtaken the church, and everything's going down the drain. It's a cry of distress with the others, with Barnabas is one of them, and the Ignatius compares himself to a man standing on a headland. It's not the Hermas, it is Ignatius. No, it isn't. It's Clement, second Clement. He's a person who's standing out of headland, watching a friend swimming out of sea, and his friend's getting farther and farther away from shore. And he's calling, his last call to come back before it's too late. He's telling the church, come back before it's too late. You're going in the wrong direction. And his voice, he says, alas, his voice is carried away by the winds. He can't reach them. Reminds you very much of the last prophets in the Book of Mormon, both the Book of Mormon and the Jaredites. So this Pastor of Hermas says, it's Hermas, incidentally, and we have it here. Behold God constructing the world in accordance with the great council. Some manuscripts have the most honored council. creating the beautiful world and turning it over to his chosen ones, that he might carry out his promise to them, which he gave him in the midst of great glory and rejoicing, that is, if they kept his laws, which they accept in great faith. Well, there's the situation exactly. You'll prove him your worth and so forth. Become a time of probation, meets together, the plan is placed before them, they vote on it and so forth, creating the world and turning it over to his chosen ones, that they might carry out his promise to them, which he gave them, that they would return to his presence, and with him partake of eternal life, in the midst of great glory and rejoicing. That is, if they keep his laws, it was to be the test, was to be a test and a probation. This life became a time of probation, as Nephi said. Which they accepted in great faith. They all voted for it. Come down. The Mandaean version, very old, way down at the end of Mesopotamia there, is interesting because it calls the creator Ta'il, gives him an Egyptian name, combining the archaic Egyptian and the Semitic names. And while giving the familiar account of the great council, it adds the important detail that three messengers were sent down to supervise the work and to instruct Adam, these three being glorious angels who were later to live upon the earth as ordinary mortals and prophets. They were to be apostles later on. And that's, you find that text in Leipold. So this takes me, I'm going to skip to something very old now. Let's go down to something that's really old. Did I leave? Just a second. I mean, bring the library along with this. Yeah, here's this Eliade. I mentioned him before. He wrote an article, he's written many books and so forth on this. Yeah, here we are. Just a number of writings to generalize here. Mircea Eliade, he's a Romanian, I think, yes. And he was at the at Swift, at the theological school in Chicago, when I was over in the Oriental Institute. And we never met. And when he had a student who was LDS, and he asked where I was teaching, where this Nibley character was. And he said, well, he's right over at the Oriental Institute, just across the crowd. But the people of the Oriental Institute never talked to the people in the theology school. That was Swift. That was Swift Hall over there. That was the library over there. And in the same way, I was doing some very interesting stuff in the library there, in Swift Library, supposed to be the theological seminary for Chicago, and they had no Catholic books. They had no Catholic journals. we have a great collection of them here, one of the best in the country, as good as you'll find. I bet it's better than you find at Notre Dame. Somebody gave Notre Dame $8 million, gave them $8 million for the books, and they spent every penny of it on books about Dante. I remember it made my friend Frank Barry so furious, but anyway, because he spent all their $8 million on one writer alone. But so the people in the two never met. But in this article on cosmogenic myths, he says he compares what his business is prehistoric shamanism and so forth, world religions. Now you can get a very good treatment comparison of world religions back throughout the world, beginning with so-called primitives and right down to the religions today, the big ones, the collection of Joseph Campbell, called Masks of the Gods. He was here 3 years ago now and gave some very fine talks, and we had some nice talks with him. But Joseph Campbell, if you want to review the general situation of world religions from the beginning, what they believed, etc., you can't do better. It's very readable, and it's in, you've got at least three volumes out, and Joseph Campbell, very good. And but Eliade says this, wherever you look, he says, you will always find this central myth of the creation, which describes the beginning of the world, including the origin of plants, animals, and man, and of marriage, and of family, and of death. Taken all together, these myths in origin constitute a fairly coherent history. Wherever you go throughout the world, you'll find about the same picture, about the same story. We're not talking at this time about the process of creation, we're talking about just about the council. But W.G. Lambert, who is perhaps the foremost surviving Babylonian scholar, I don't know, I'll have to ask some of our people here, but he is the biggest editor of Babylonian text today. W.G. Lambert says, the first major conclusion is that the epic of creation is a norm of Babylonian or Sumerian cosmology. You'll find it there. And it's a sectarian aberration. Well, this one, and we find these things spread around everywhere, but it's not we kept to the Babylonian. This goes in the other book. But here, Grappo, Herman Grappo. Grappo's is better here. He is the editor of the big, many volumes. How many volumes? Oh, five big volumes of the Egyptian dictionary. It took him years and years. 3 million entries in it. That's a lot of work to make 3 million entries in a dictionary. 3 million note slips he collected. Well, he worked with Hermann Grappo. They worked together. It was financed by the Kaiser in Berlin, and it went on years and years and years collecting. And it's still the standard, the only one. It's the veritable book. It's the Egyptian dictionary. But he has written this on the world before the creation. He says, now you turn to the Egyptian text on the subject, you'll find Gnawa parallel, exact parallels from the Old Testament, from the Enuma Elish, the old Babylonian epic of creation, from the Rig Veda, which is the Indo-European. In 1700 BC, it entered into India, but before then it was up in Central Asia, the Rig Veda. See, Sanskrit is a related language to it. And so this, you'll find this in the religion, both of Buddhism and Hinduism, and so forth. And also the Vesselbrunnen prayer in Old High German. You'll find it in the sagas, and you'll find it in the Veluspa. Because the Veluspa is the, well, Gylfaginning is a marvelous one. If you go into the sagas, their account of the creation is something. And of course, always, it's with the council here and their discussion in the Lokasena. That's one of the best descriptions of the council. Lokasena, Loki, you see, is Satan, who will not accept the plan. He rejects it, and he comes in, and he denounces it, and he starts exposing the private lives of all the gods, and they don't like that. And Wotan keeps saying to him, Thegithu, Loki, Thegithu, shut up, Loki, shut up. Don't tell us anymore. We don't want to hear that. And so he's cast out. But notice the thing is that these are international. We'll find it in the pyramid text, in the Book of the Dead, in the Greek and Roman temple inscriptions and so forth. The Nagalan on the Avesta teaching the same thing. These lines from Hesiod's Theognomy are good. The oldest Greek story of the creation is Hesiod's Theogony, the beginning of the gods. And it's very much in line with the rest of them. But some Enoch literature. Some would place him before Homer, but his date is easy to remember. It's 777. He's supposed to have reached his prime in the year 777 BC. But this line here, I think Milton must have lifted it. He hails the muse and asks the muse to teach him. Tell me how first in the beginning the gods and the earth came into existence. Or how first on earth these things were planted down on earth and the gods set up court on Olympus and so forth. But that's almost exactly the way Milton puts it, isn't it? And chiefly thou, O Spirit, let us prefer, before all temples, the upright heart and pure, instruct me for thou knowest. Oh no, or the other one. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree's bitter taste, we started this the last time, God lift into the world. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the top of Horeb and Sinai didst inspire that shepherd of the people who first taught in the beginning how the heaven and earth rose out of chaos. Or if Zion's hill content thee more, delight thee more, whose spring was it that flows hard by the fast by the oracle of God, or Silo's spring that flows fast by the oracle of God, I hence invite thy aid to my adventurous muse that in no common flight intends, adventurous is the word, intends to soar while it pursues things yet, unattempted yet in prose and rhyme. See, he calls the muse to instruct him how things began in the beginning. And this is the way the epic story and the creation stories begin. Almost the identical words are used in Hesiod. We mentioned the last time that Milton was condemned because in his works his angels are too literal, they're too physical. Well, here he is. But this is so that the first Greek account, the oldest Greek account we have, starts out quoting Milton word for word. What do you know about that? Tell me how first in the beginning the gods and the earth came into existence. And so on. And then it tells us about these things. But we're going to talk about a particular one here. Do you have anything else in the way of
of introductions? Ah, that's the Babylonian we have here. No, I'm going to go now to the... Boy, don't have much time.
Let's get started on it. I'm going to talk about the oldest book in the world. You mentioned it before. I suppose you mentioned it before. It is this. I suppose we should have a close-up of this. Can you all see it from here? Can you all read it from here? It's a little thing. It's reproduced here. This is blacker ink. I had this yesterday because it's blacker ink. This is rather faint. It's rather tiny. This is the Memphite Theology or the Shabako Stone. It's considered, I think it was Professor Prestett's greatest achievement was to discover the importance of this. And if you want to know about it, read Breasted's book. Of course, it's long out of date now. It's back 1912, called The Origins of Religion. This is, he takes as the primal. This is the text in which you get your, and it is what a religious document is. I say the oldest book in the world. You're going to expect this to be primitive, mumbo-jumbo, a lot of hocus-pocus, wonders and miracles and all this. Ah, just wait. It is the Shabako text. Shabako was the third king of the 25th dynasty. Interesting relationships to the Book of Mormon here. His name means wildcat. He came to the throne about 716 B.C. And you say, well, is this the oldest in the world? Ah, just wait. With this 25th dynasty, the 25th dynasty was founded by Kashta, and then his son was Pyanki, and it's very funny. Back in the 21st dynasty, it was founded by a person called Korihor, whose son was Pyanki. You know, Pyanki's a very funny name. You don't invent a thing like that. And it wasn't discovered during the 1880s. But Pa'anki, well, to the 70s. But Pa'anki, this is a name we have in the Book of Mormon. And he has business with Korihor. And Pa'anki, they were priests in Egypt. They were priests of Ammon. Korihor was a priest of Ammon who usurped the power of the state. His son Pa'anki became king. In the Book of Mormon, Alma, they bring the first man to trial when they set up the old-fashioned courts. And Alma, the guy's called Korihor, and Alma accuses him and says, this is the first time anything like this has happened since the old world. They restored these things. You start comparing these names, and there's some amazing names turn up. They certainly impressed Professor Albright. Anyway, it is a script of a play. They came from Ethiopia, they were Ethiopian kings. But, well, then the one who followed after him, Shavitka, then comes the famous Taharqa. Now, Taharqa delivered Jerusalem practically from the Assyrians, and he was, dynasty was held in great esteem. And their names would be adopted in Jerusalem by the Jews. This interloping dynasty had championed Israel, as a matter of fact. And you're going to get more of that. We're not going to get into the Book of Mormon here. The thing is that to celebrate the founding of this dynasty and to justify and sanctify it, he decided to restore the oldest temple in Egypt, the original temple, the one that was built to celebrate the founding of the first dynasty by Menes. Menes built it. It was the White Temple at Memphis. And he was to restore it and performed the same rites and ordinances, they didn't know about this at the time, that were performed when the kingdom of Egypt was originally found. Let me see. We don't have too much time, do we? Can't finish it. When the kingdom was originally found, by Menes, that's put today, everybody argues about it, but around 3100 B.C. But at that time, it was very old. Menes to found it. See, he was founding the order of God on earth, the celestial order on earth. He built the temple, and there they rehearsed in dramatic form the council in heaven, the creation of the earth, and the fall, and the redemption, and all these things, and this in this document. Well, when Shabako wanted to renew the order of things and reestablish the ancient practices, which were very ancient, I say at this time, in the time of Menes, Dynasty 1, he decided to renovate the temple, and in the process, in the cornerstone, they discovered a document. It was a rolled-up scroll of leather, and he tells us about it here. It was the script of a play, refer to it now, the script of a play performed at the installation of the first king of Egypt. The dedication of the first temple of the United Egypt to celebrate the beginning of the new rule, a new dynasty, a new nation, a new age of the world, and it was held, of course, at the new year. The play begins with the council in heaven and the controversy over the right to dominion, with Horus winning over Seth, being recognized as the firstborn and the sole heir, and the opener of the ways. More than a third of the text is missing. That's the middle part here. Oh, I have to tell you about it. That's where a column stood. That's where a column stood. It was found at Memphis. But you see, this is the copy that was made at that time. But it was found, it was brought to the British Museum way back in 1805. I think it was 1805 or 7. See, the French went into Egypt and the English came and took over. And they took this to the British Museum. And it's been there since 1805 or 7, either one. I think it's 1805. And it was very worn. So they had difficulty reading it. And various attempts were made. Every generation or so, someone would try to come out with it. Then, new sophisticated methods of lighting and a much better knowledge of old Egyptian grammar, because it turns out it was in the archaic form of the language, enabled Sather to produce in 1929 the definitive text of it. So we have the text of it here, and we know what it says. And it is a marvelous document, which we'll read the next time.